This week on Education Radio.
Is U.S. education in crisis? We hear this at every turn. The crisis today, however, is not what you think it is. The crisis is caused by No Child Left Behind. We have a federal law designed to fail almost every school in America.
Welcome to Education Radio. I'm Barbara Mataloni.
And I'm Chris Herland.
Today, we will be hearing from Diane Ravitch as she spoke at the Save Our Schools Conference in Washington, D.C. this past July. For the past 30 years, education reform has been pushed by policymakers and the corporate elite with a neoliberal agenda. Neoliberalism replaces democratic engagement with market forces in the public sphere while transferring public monies into private profit. Public education is a prime target. Thus far, this approach to education reform has brought us high-stakes testing, surveillance, charter schools, and the increasing privatization of our public schools at the expense of a rich educational experience for all children.
Diane Ravitch was once a staunch supporter of neoliberal ideology and education reform as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. She continued promoting these policies in both the Clinton and Bush II administrations as a member of the National Assessment Governing Board. She was also an advocate of No Child Left Behind. Diane Ravitch has since renounced her previous positions. Her recent book, The Death and Life of a Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, describes her transformation and critiques the policies of education reform. Here's what she had to say.
This has been a most amazing year for me, as it has been for all of you. I started off in February of 2010 talking about the issues that we're all concerned about today. Over the past year and a few months, I've spoken to well over 100,000 people, and that included people who are state school board members, administrators, parents, civic leaders, course teachers. And, you know, I was amazed when Secretary Duncan said there was zero opposition to his agenda, because I never found anybody out of those 100,000 people who likes his agenda. So he's helped to bring us together, so I guess I should pay tribute to him, too. What's happened over this past year, in addition to having this incredible experience of meeting people across the country and getting feedback and learning so much about what's happening in communities and what's happening to our schools and the devastating attacks on teachers, is that I've been subject to the right-wing attack machine. The latest came out just today. I couldn't read it. I've stopped reading these things. But basically, I've had a year of brickbats, of insults. I've been called a hypocrite, insincere, dishonest, a pathological liar. I cherry-picked my data. I did it for the money. I mean, gosh, if I did it for the money, why wouldn't I be following Bill Gates, for God's sakes? I could get millions if I were on his side. But the two best things I've been called this year was, and I owe these both to Jonathan Alter. Last fall, he said in an article about Bill Gates that I was Bill Gates' chief adversary. Now, you have to understand, I don't have a secretary. I don't have a research assistant. It's just me and a phone call once in a while to Rita. I'm his chief adversary. And what is his staff, 1,000 people? But the other thing that Jonathan Alter said, and he said it in two articles, was that I was the Whitaker Chambers of school reform. Now, I'm very proud to be Bill Gates' chief adversary, and I would like to say to Jonathan Alter, I would much rather be Whitaker Chambers than Alger Hiss. But if you're a teacher, or if you're a parent, you've taken a whole lot worse insults and real hits than I have. If you're a teacher, you've seen your state legislature pass bills to cut your salary, cut your pension, take away your health care benefits, take away your collective bargaining rights, base your evaluation on your students' test scores. You've seen governors call you greedy, one of them who calls you a union thug. I was glad to see the t-shirt, I am a proud union thug. You have watched as the richest man in America told the governors how to cut your salary. You wonder if your profession will survive and your right to wonder. If you're a parent, you've seen your child subjected to more tests, more interim assessments to get ready for the real test, more test preparation to get ready for the interim assessments to get ready for the real test. You've seen your child's class sizes grow larger. You've watched in fear and awe as your district has cut back on the arts, on music, dance, physical education, and now they're developing tests for the arts and music and dance and physical education that they already cut. And you may be a parent or a teacher of a school that was closed because it didn't meet No Child Left Behind's idiotic and insane annual targets. Wherever you're coming from, and whatever your reasons, thank you for being here today. I know that all of you have made a tremendous effort and sacrifice to be here. We all need to speak up. We all need to be heard to save our schools from this current so-called reform movement. If we don't speak up, there'll be more privatization of public schools. If we don't stand up for public education, we'll see more legislatures enacting voucher legislation and more public funding going to schools of dubious quality. And if we don't speak out, we'll see thousands more privately managed charter schools, even though very few of them are better than regular public schools. We'll see more virtual schools. We'll see Rupert Murdoch bringing in millions, and as he sees it, a $500 billion market in the virtual online industry, which he wants to corner. So I decided that the last thing you need to hear this morning is a speech. After all, I've given so many speeches, so I wanted to do something a little different. I know many of you are teachers. You don't believe in giving speeches. It's the wrong thing to do. So I'm going to do something that I've never done before, and it may be a total flop, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to interview myself. So I'm going to begin by saying, Dr. Ravitch, do you mind if I call you Diane? Here's your first question. Is U.S. education in crisis? Crisis, crisis. We hear this at every turn. Yes, we are in crisis, but you have to understand we've been in crisis for 100 years. In the 1910s, there was a crisis because we didn't have enough industrial education. We weren't preparing children for the industrial age. And so Congress reacted by passing the Smith-Hughes Vocational and Industrial Education Act in 1917 to resolve that crisis. And then in the 1920s, we had a crisis because our urban schools were overwhelmed with immigrant children who couldn't speak English. In the 1930s, there was a huge crisis because the schools were not meeting the needs of a depressed economy. In the 1940s, the schools were overcrowded and antiquated. There had been no investment in them because of the war years. And we were in crisis, the terrible disrepair, and they were not ready for the atomic age. That's what they said during that crisis. In the 1950s, we had crisis after crisis. The 1950s is now referred to, by the way, in Waiting for Superman and in Newsweek as the Golden Age. But in the 1950s, we found out that Johnny can't read. Rudolf Flesch wrote a bestseller, huge bestseller, called Why Johnny Can't Read. And then someone wrote Why Johnny Can't Do Math and Why Johnny Can't Write. That was the 1950s, the Golden Age. And then we had Sputnik. And when Sputnik went up in 1957, we found out that the Russians launched Sputnik because our schools were so bad. And there was an admiral named Hyman Rickover who wrote a book about how terrible the schools were and how they were responsible and why the Russians had overtaken us because of our bad schools. That was the Golden Age. And then in the 1960s, we learned that our schools were responsible for institutionalized racism and that there was this tremendous achievement gap in the 60s caused by the schools, and there was a crisis of the disadvantaged. And suddenly the society discovered that there's poverty in America. That was the discovery of the 1960s. Then in the 1970s, there was yet another crisis. It was called, as a popular book of the time called it, Charles Silverman, Crisis in the Classroom. That crisis was that so many children were so bored and disengaged and turned off and that our schools were mindless and we needed a revolution. Then in the 1980s, we discovered we were a nation at risk. We have been at risk nonstop since 1983. Are we in a crisis? Of course we're in a crisis. When were we not in a crisis? The crisis today, however, is not what you think it is. The crisis is caused by No Child Left Behind. We have a federal... We have a federal law that, to quote a phrase from David Berliner and Bruce Biddle, is a manufactured crisis. We have a federal law designed to fail almost every school in America. Just the other day, I read that in the state of New Mexico, 87% of the public schools are now failing schools. 87%. That's where we're all heading. So then we come to the next question. Diane. Is U.S. education declining? This is what we read everywhere. We're in decline. We're in free fall. Newsweek said the decline started about 50 years ago. Once upon a time, Newsweek said, U.S. schools were first in the world. Waiting for Superman said, our schools started to decline about 40 years ago. Well, three big things have happened in these past 40 to 50 years. First of all, our schools dealt with the issue of racial segregation, not satisfactorily to be sure, because by many calculations they're more segregated today than they have been in the past 30 or 40 years, but at least we dealt with what was a very traumatic and difficult issue, and there were real benefits for African American children. Secondly, our schools had to include children with disabilities, most of whom were not in a school but were shunted aside until the passage of the law in 1975 and court decisions since that time. So we've had desegregation, we've had inclusion, we have had in these past 40 years, 50 years, massive waves of immigration, so that today, unlike 1950, in our schools we have many integrated schools, inclusion of children with disability, many children who have limited English. This is all huge. What an incredible thing that our schools were able to deal with one after another of these major changes. And yet we have people saying it was better 50 years ago when we didn't have all those kids in school, when the special ed kids were shunted aside, when there were racially segregated schools, when everybody spoke English. But those are not the schools we have today, and they don't seem to remember that. But are our schools in decline? If you look at the NAEP scores, go back to when NAEP started in the early 70s, we have seen slow and steady progress, particularly for African American children, and particularly in the 1970s and 1980s, in part because of desegregation, in part because of reduced class sizes, and lots of other things. Paul Barton of ETS wrote about this in a report called The Black-White Achievement Gap, When Progress Stopped. When progress stopped was when we got into our current NCLB era. Since the first NAEP test in the early 1970s, the black-white achievement gap has been cut in half. So when they tell you our schools are declining, tell them, nonsense, you don't know what you're talking about. That's not nearly enough. That's not nearly enough, but it's real progress. And so long as we continue to have, as we do, concentrated racial isolation and poverty, that gap will remain. But what about all those terrible international test scores, Diane? Didn't Secretary Duncan say those international test scores were a wake-up call? Didn't President Obama say this is our Sputnik moment? What about 1957 when the Soviets beat us into space and our lousy schools were to blame? Well, what Secretary Duncan and President Obama don't seem to know is that in the mid-1960s, that's when the international assessment started. And the first international assessment, we came in 12th out of 12. We've never been first in the world on the international assessment. We've never even been second in the world on the international assessments. We just don't do well on those damned international assessments. Now, some people might say it's the methodology, it's the sampling techniques, whatever. But this has not been our fort. What I conclude about the international assessments is they don't predict future economic decline or success, because we ought to be the lowest economic nation in the world based on the international assessments, and we're not. Typically, we have been in the bottom quartile. We're making progress. We're right at the international average now. But if these international assessments were great predictors, we would have disappeared by now. But we're here, and the Soviet Union, I might remind you, is gone. Something else that you ought to know about the international assessments, and that is that the latest one, which is called PISA, which came out in December of 2010, when you look at the rates of who scores what on those tests, one of the reports that came out was called Highlights from PISA. And has a little chart, I think it's page 15 of Highlights from PISA, and it disaggregates test scores for the United States by poverty level of the school. Our low-poverty schools, the schools where 10% or less of the children get free or reduced price lunch, are the best in the world. They have the highest scores. They have scores significantly higher than Finland and Korea. Our schools that are 25% or less poverty schools are tied with Finland and Korea. So schools are not the problem. Poverty is the problem. Now I'm sure that if Arne Duncan or Michelle Rhee or Joel Klein were here, they'd say, there you go, making excuses again. No, I'm talking facts here, folks. Well, what role does poverty play? What role does poverty play in student performance? Well, on every test that we now have in use, whether it's high stakes, low stakes, or no stakes, poverty is a reliable predictor of test scores. Whether you look at the SAT, the ACT, the NAEP, or the state test, kids from affluent families have much higher scores than kids who live in poverty. Just to give you an example, on the latest SAT for reading, students in the lowest income bracket, and that is kids where the family income is under $20,000, have an average score of 437, while students in the highest income bracket, whose families have an income over $200,000 a year, have a mean score of 568. That's a gap of 120 points. The gap is just as large in mathematics. And what's interesting, if you look at the chart in the College Board report, is that the increase goes up in a regular way. As income goes up, test scores go up with great regularity. There's no real change anywhere in the middle. Poverty is associated with poor attendance, ill health, poor nutrition, sometimes homelessness, frequent change of residence, living in deteriorating and dangerous neighborhoods. These factors actually affect children's motivation and their academic performance. Believe it or not, it's true. It is really true. I mean, we've had so many studies that I could show you an entire, probably a whole floor in the library and the Teachers College campus that say these things are true. They are not excuses. It's reality that we should deal with. Furthermore, we know that poor women, because they're less likely to get adequate health care during their pregnancy and to get good nutrition, are likely to give birth to low birth weight babies. And low birth weight babies are one-third more likely to be born with learning disabilities. So poverty has a direct impact even before children arrive in school for their first day. The achievement gap begins before the first day of school. Are you saying that poor children can't learn? That's what Jonathan Schnur said. That's what he told me. No, of course not. Poor children can learn. They can do incredibly well in school. They can excel. But it's just wrong not to recognize that the deck is stacked against poor children. And of course poor children can do incredibly well, but it's an excuse. What you're saying is an excuse not to deal with the core issues that prevent most poor children from doing well. Every child in America should get a good start in life and arrive in school ready to learn. There's no excuse for the richest nation in the world to tolerate so much poverty.
Diane Ravitch gave this keynote address at American University in Washington, D.C. during the Save Our Schools conference last July. I'm Tim Sutton. You're listening to Education Radio. We'll be back after this break.
The Rangers had a homecoming in Harlem late last night. And a magic rat drove his sleek machine over a Jersey state line. Barefoot girl sitting on the hood of a Dodge, drinking warm beer in the soft summer rain. The rat pulls in the town, rolls up his pants. Together they take a stab at romance and disappear down Flamingo Lane. Will a maximum lawman run down Flamingo, chasing her in a barefoot girl? The The kids around here look just like shadows, always quiet, holding hands. From the churches to the jails, tonight all is silence in the world. As we take our stand down in jungle land. The midnight gangs assemble and picked a rendezvous for the night. They'll meet neath that giant Exxon sign that brings this first light.
You're listening to Education Radio. Let's get back to Diane Ravitch.
So, what do you think of No Child Left Behind? Oh, I would say it was probably one of the worst pieces of federal legislation ever passed. No. I take that back. It is the very worst piece of legislation ever passed. It was supposed to be reauthorized in 2007, but Congress can't agree to what to put in its place. Some want to be more punitive. A few of congressmen realize it doesn't work. It actually has very few friends or supporters, but they can't agree on what to replace it with. Unfortunately, President Obama wants to replace it with a law that would concentrate on the bottom 5,000 schools and subject them to turnaround. So we would be closing 5,000 schools a year, and where he expects to find 5,000 brilliant teachers and an army of new, 5,000 brilliant principals and an army of new teachers is something that remains unexplained. But NCLB set an impossible goal, and that is that 100% of students would be proficient in reading and math by 2014, and no state is even close to meeting that goal. So by 2014, if the law is not changed, nearly 100% of our schools will be failures. No other nation in the world has ever passed a law designed to fail almost every one of its schools. This is totally insane. Now, on the basis of this impossible demand, schools are narrowing their curriculum, eliminating the arts and other subjects. States are gaming the system by lowering the passing mark on their test, and grown-ups are cheating to save their jobs. Furthermore, schools are closing, principals and teachers are being fired, all because they could not meet an impossible goal without lying or cheating. No Child Left Behind has made testing the central preoccupation and goal of school reform, and this is simply ludicrous. Instruction, inspiration, knowledge, love of learning should be our goals, not higher test scores on multiple choice tests. NCLB, which has been called all kinds of things, including No Consultant Left Behind. There are districts now that are spending more and more money on consultants to teach them how to turn around a school, even though they've never turned one around, how to transform a school, how to do this, how to do that, how to get higher test scores. No Child Left Behind has been a bonanza for the testing companies. It's been a bonanza for people who sell you advice on how to do things. It's been a tragedy for the students and the teachers and the educators and families. Okay, so I'm almost loath to ask this question, but what do you think of Race to the Top? If you like NCLB, you'll love Race to the Top. Race to the Top takes all the assumptions of No Child Left Behind and doubles down. Just like NCLB, Race to the Top believes in carrots and sticks, rewards and punishments, and test scores is the ultimate goal of education. Race to the Top says if states want to win federal funding, they must award merit pay based on test scores. They must agree to close schools based on test scores, fire their staffs, turn them into charters based on test scores. They must agree to evaluate teachers based on test scores. Race to the Top, frankly, is wrong to use the metaphor of a race. American education is not a race to anywhere. American education is about equality of educational opportunity. That's not a race. By definition, a race has a few winners and a lot of losers. Our goal in education is not to pick winners, but to enable every child to prepare for a full and productive life in American society. Well, what do you think about this idea? It's very popular, evaluating teachers by test scores. This is one of the worst ideas ever. This is something that George W. Bush could have only dreamed of doing. It took a Democratic president to sell it. If scores go up over the course of a year, great teacher. If the scores are flat, or they go down, bad teacher. You're not effective unless you can get those scores up. Testing experts warn that the methods used to calculate teacher quality by test scores are inaccurate and unstable. There are many factors that influence test scores, not just the teacher. Students are not randomly assigned. The same teacher may be at the top of the ratings one year and the bottom the next year, depending on the composition of his or her class. There's a large body of research that warns against using value-added assessment to rate teachers. I mean, if value-added assessment works, why wouldn't we look to Tennessee, which has been using it since 1988, as the number one state in the country? Anyone here from Tennessee? Number one state in the country? Not. And it's not because of the teachers, it's because that method doesn't work to raise anything except the number of people you can fire. And of course, if teachers are judged by test scores, they will be compelled to teach to the test, narrow the curriculum, and sadly, some will cheat. Well, where's the logic in any of this? Why should politicians design evaluation systems for teachers? What do they know about it? Nothing. Zero. Zip. How can they decide whether the test score should count for 50% or 12% or 92%? Why do they disregard all the experts who tell them that these methods don't work, that they're inaccurate and unstable? Why shouldn't the methods of evaluation for professionals be designed by professionals, not legislators? Now, you know, a lot of people are saying, and I just read a book the other day that said the teachers are the main cause of test scores. I keep hearing this. I hear it from on high in Washington, they say it. Lots of think tanks are saying it. Well, it's not true. Teachers are not the main cause of test scores. What we do know from all these economists, and I don't know how they know it, but this is what they say. They say that teachers are the most important factor within the school. And that sounds reasonable. Teachers are the most important factor within the school, but that the influence of the teacher is dwarfed by the influence of the family, especially family income. And the student also has a huge impact on their test scores, whether they're willing to work or not. Those things make a bigger difference than the teacher. But again, I can't say this is actually true, it's just what economists say. Is it true that teachers can never be fired? I mean, I did see that in Waiting for Superman. It must be true, right? Because it was in the movies? Is it true that teachers have lifetime tenure? Well, no. Typically, teachers have no job protection at all for the first 3 or 4 years. And during that time, they're supposed to be evaluated. Someone's supposed to visit their classroom, make a decision about whether they're a good teacher, give them help so that they can become a better teacher. And at some point, the principal makes a decision about whether or not they get tenure. When they get tenure, it's not the same thing as a university professor. When a university professor gets tenure, they have a lifetime job. When a teacher gets tenure, that means they have the right to a hearing if somebody wants to fire them. It doesn't seem so onerous. It's due process. It's a good old-fashioned American idea. If somebody wants to fire you, they should present evidence that you're incompetent or whatever it is they're charging. And in fact, many teachers are fired. Attrition rate in the first 5 years of teaching is 50%. This is not true in law. It's not true in medicine. 50% of people who enter teaching are gone within the first 5 years. Some of them were fired, some of them quit. No other profession that I know of has such a high attrition rate. But there is an answer to all this, isn't there? Isn't it Teach for America? Well, you know, I think Teach for America is a really nice idea. I like the Peace Corps, too. But when people go off to join the Peace Corps, we don't send them to be ambassadors. So every year, Teach for America selects 8,000 of our very brightest, most idealistic young college graduates and sends them to teach in urban and rural schools. And they get 5 weeks of training. And they agree to stay for 2 years. Some of them stay 3 years. Most of them are gone at the end of 3 years. And the district pays Teach for America $5,000 for each person they place. So it's kind of expensive for the district. Now, TFA does nothing to change the profession because, after all, most of them are gone within 2 to 3 years. But it's become a fast track for the Ivy League. And many years ago, I was lecturing at Brown. This probably goes back 25 years or so. And a young woman came up and she said, I'd like to be an education policy maker. How do I do that? I said, well, you could start by becoming a teacher. And she said, no, I don't want to teach. I just want to be a policy maker. And I realized what Teach for America has done is become a fast track for young people like her. They just have to commit to the 2 years, and soon they'll be commissioner of education in Tennessee. Or they can start a charter school. You can just, by the age of, as I was reading in a new book that's coming out soon, you can be the principal or the assistant principal by the age of 25, 26. That's really hard to do in a typical school system. TFA is so popular amongst corporations and foundations and even the U.S. Department of Education that it's actually taken all the air out of any discussion about real changes and the recruitment and retention and preparation of teachers who plan to make a career of teaching. Over the past decade, Teach for America, and I estimate this conservatively, has raised nearly $500 million. And it just got $49 million from the ultra-conservative Walton Foundation just the other day. This adds to the $100 million that four foundations gave it about 6 months ago, and the $50 million that the U.S. Department of Education gave it a few months ago, plus the earmark that it gets from Congress. I mean, on and on. But, you know, they're doing very well, but it's not very good for systemic reform. Now, just moving along, Diane, do you think that charters are the way to reform U.S. education? Well, I've often said that the original idea of charters was a good one. The original idea being that the charters would help the public schools, collaborate with the public schools, show innovative ways to bring back the kids that were lost to education, bring in the kids from who were dropouts or about to drop out. That was the original idea. And they would focus on the neediest kids and would be integrally supportive of public education. But that's not what's happening now. Now most of the charters, and especially the charter chains, are aggressively seeking to replace regular public schools, taking away their space and bragging that they're better. Their test scores are higher. They have become a favorite of the Wall Street hedge fund managers, of the bankers, of the real estate speculators. One of the charter chains in New York City, the Harlem Success Academy, was written about just the other day. They spend $1.6 million in a single year just for marketing. Wow. Marketing, sending out, putting out posters and flyers and mailings and inundating so that they can have thousands of children at their lottery and offer only a handful of places. And then the lottery itself becomes an advertisement for having more charters. We also know that many of the charters don't take a fair share of kids with disabilities, particularly the children with the most profound disabilities, and they certainly don't take a fair share of children with limited English speaking. And so, yeah, they do better. They get higher test scores. It's easy to do it when you're dealing with the kids with the fewest problems, and also when you can have, as many of the charters do, an attrition rate where you don't replace the kids who leave. And most of the kids leaving are the low-performing kids. That helps your test scores. And it's a competitive marketplace. So today we have about 5,000, probably more than 5,000 by now, charters. They range from some that are really excellent charters to some that are really horrible charters. On average, though, they don't produce better results than regular public schools. That's been shown again and again in study after study. Some of the states now are promoting charters because the Republican legislators have always wanted privatization. And some of the charter sponsors, and this has been demonstrated particularly in Ohio and Pennsylvania, big campaign contributions going to legislators to pick them off and make them into charter champions. It's happened in New York as well. One of our charter champions just lost his position and was hired by Mayor Bloomberg to work in one of his firms. So, again, in a book I'm reading, I learned that Democrats for Education Reform, which is a hedge fund manager group devoted to spreading charters, Democrats for Education Reform, remember their name, they're hedge fund managers. They, over the last 3 years, spent $17 million on state and local races to promote charter candidates. And they're all over the country. They may be in your state. Big battle coming up for the school board in Denver this fall. And DFER and its friends pumping lots of money and millions in to overwhelm parents and teachers and community supporters. Some of the charter chains are taking advantage of federal tax credits. There's something called the New Market Tax Credit Program, which was intended to encourage investment in low-income communities. But it turns out, as Juan Gonzalez of the New York Daily News wrote, these investment companies can double their money through the New Market Tax Credit Program in 7 years. It's a nice, safe investment guaranteed by government money by investing in new charter construction. So what did we learn recently? A major equity group has put up $500 million to sponsor high school dropout tennis star Andre Agassi's charter school chain. Is this philanthropy or is it a smart investment? I report and you decide.
You're listening to Diane Ravitch's keynote speech from the Save Our Schools conference that took place in July at American University in Washington, D.C. This is Education Radio. I'm Tim Scott. We'll be right back.
What's going three may step in me, and that's a magic number.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure. Measure in the music, racing three parts. Casually see, but don't do like the soul. Cause seeing and doing are action for monkeys. Doing hip hop, hustle, no rock and roll. Unless your name's Brewster, cause Brewster's a punk. Three. Parents let go, cause it's magic in the air. Criticizing rap shows you're out of order. Stop looking, listen to the phrase in Fred Astaire's. And don't get offended while Mace Do-Si-Do's your daughter. A dry camera roll system is now set. Fly around the store under Daisy Productions. It stands for the inner sound. Y'all in your Quebec, that the action's not a trick, but show me the function. Everybody wants to be a DJ, everybody wants to be an MC, but being speakers are the best, and you don't have to guess. De La Soul Posse consists of three, and that's the magic number.
Three.
This here piece of the pie is not dessert, but the course that we dine at. Three out of every darn time, the effect is, when a daisy grows in your mind. Showing true position, this here piece is kissing.
Welcome back to Education Radio. We now return to Diane Ravitch.
So, okay, we've gotten through charters. How about vouchers? Do vouchers work? Well, we could look to Milwaukee. I mean, we've had now 50 years of advocacy for vouchers, and people always say, you know, we'll never know till it's tried. Well, in Milwaukee, there have been vouchers for 21 years. And we now know that at least if you look at test scores, there's no difference. The kids in the voucher schools do no better than the kids in the regular public schools. And they all do terribly, by the way. There was no rising tide, no boats were lifted. But Milwaukee this past, last time the NAEP was administered, Milwaukee participated. And we learned from NAEP 2009 that the Milwaukee students, the black students in the Milwaukee schools, perform at the same level as black students in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama. So vouchers did nothing, zero, zip. For anybody in Milwaukee, other than to dispense $1 billion of Wisconsin money for voucher schools, many of which are terrible schools. So Governor Scott Walker just recently got the legislature to pass voucher legislation, expanding the voucher program to Racine County, lifting the income cap so that more kids in Milwaukee could benefit by this useless program. Okay, so how about merit pay? How are we doing on merit pay? Well, merit pay is what I call the idea that never works and never dies. It's been tried again and again and again since the 1920s, and it has never worked. But the people who believe in it never give up. So Vanderbilt University last fall, almost a year ago, released the most comprehensive, most rigorous, most scientific study ever of vouchers, and they offered a bonus. They said, you know, teachers won't be motivated by only $2,000 or $3,000. They're too lazy to be motivated by a little bump in their salary. We're going to offer a bonus of $15,000 to get test scores up. That's real money. After 3 years, they concluded that it didn't make a difference. No difference. Teachers without the bonus got the same test scores that the teachers who did. They were all working as hard as they knew how, and it didn't make a difference. And the next day, the U.S. Department of Education released $500 million for new merit pay plans and promised that there's another $500 million in the works, another $1 billion wasted on something that has no evidence. New York City just a week ago announced the close down of its three-year merit pay plan, in which the bonus went to the whole school. And they spent $56 million giving bonuses out and concluded that it made no difference. But they said, we will find another way to give merit pay. Next time it'll work. It's always going to work next time. Oh, okay, so I have to ask you this. Should schools try to operate like businesses? After all, businesses are efficient. The marketplace works, right? Yeah. Well, I can't help but think of September 2008. I can't help remembering when my stock portfolio disappeared overnight because the marketplace failed. But you know, what about the portfolio model? You know the portfolio model? They were asking me about this in New Haven. Oh yeah, that's the one where you treat your schools like a stock portfolio. And you keep the winners and sell the losers. Well, you know, this kind of business thinking is simply not appropriate to schools. It's also not 21st century thinking. This is early 20th century thinking. This is the idea that people need to be incentivized with a whip or a bonus. This goes back to Frederick Winslow Taylor, paying people by piece rates, determining by time and motion studies who can do it fastest, and then say everybody else should be able to meet that goal. It also smacks of B.F. Skinner and behaviorism. This is the early 20th century industrial model. Education's not a business. There are no profits or losses in education, other than the losses of children. Everyone in education is supposed to succeed. All of our schools should be well-equipped and well-resourced. We can't, as in the famous blueberry story, we can't toss out the bad blueberries. They're our kids. We have to take care of them, too. We have to have a healthy private sector, and we have to have a healthy public sector. We have to have public libraries, public beaches, public transit, public this, public that. We cannot have everything privatized. We know what happens when everything is privatized. The costs go up, and people get thrown out. Well, so, Diane, don't you think there is nonetheless a good case to be made for the value of incentives? Everybody responds to incentives, right? People like to know that there's a prize at the end of the rainbow. Well, I wouldn't think so. I mean, you might want to, for example, look at the latest study that came out from the National Academy of Sciences, the National Research Council. The National Research Council is the nation's most prestigious research body. They released the day before Memorial Day, which I would say was bad timing on their part, a 9-year study. It was done by a panel of 17 of the world's most renowned experts in the social sciences. And they concluded that incentives and test-based accountability don't work. And they looked at NCLB, they looked at merit pay, they said the graduation rates were actually depressed by all of these incentives. And they said that as we all know that when you rely on incentives, you get inflated test scores, cheating, gaming the system, all of those negative things result, and that's not the way at all it works. Another thing that we get from all of this emphasis on incentives and rewards is the Atlanta cheating scandal. what the report there, which was absolutely devastating, 500 pages I think it was, said there was a culture of fear, intimidation, and retaliation. That the superintendent would hold a mass meeting in a big auditorium, and the principals whose scores went up sat next to her, and the principals that couldn't raise their scores were placed way up in the balcony. And the principals put the pressure on the teachers, and people cheated. There was a culture. It was, as my Aaron Palace at Teachers College said, it was an example of organizational dysfunction. And this was caused, as the investigators said, not me, the investigators, by unrealistic targets and extreme pressure. So if we want to do 21st century thinking, we would get away from B.F. Skinner, get away from Frederick Winslow Taylor, and instead listen to Daniel Pink. Listen to Dan Ariely. Dan Ariely, who was one of the members of that 17-member panel of the National Research Council, and his most recent book, I think, is called Predictably Irrational. And then a wonderful book by Edward Deci, D-E-C-I. Edward Deci is one of the pioneers of the study of the motivation, of the psychology of motivation. And he says that when you pay people to do what you want them to do, you rob them of their autonomy. And that control doesn't work nearly as well as inspiration. People work harder out of a sense of idealism and a sense of purpose and a passion for self-direction. And it's that intrinsic motivation that we have to find and build on, not the incentives and punishments. That when you use incentives and punishments, you actually discourage performance. So how can we promote innovation and creativity and imagination? Well, we could begin by having assessments that consist of demonstrations, of exhibitions, not multiple choice questions, of emphasizing the importance of the arts, science projects, of essays, of active participation, of creating settings where what's valued is imagination and creativity. If we value those things, we're likelier to get them. We have a system now where we devalue them and we will not get them. So, finally, I'm going to give you two more questions. One, what should we be doing to improve our schools? One way to start would be, well, first of all, we have to elect a whole lot of different people. Anybody here from Ohio? You got to work on that referendum and turn back SB 5. That's one. Throw out those rascals in Wisconsin. If you're a teacher, if you're a parent, if you're a school administrator, if you're a school board member, get involved, stay involved, contact your congressman, visit them in their offices. We got to change things. One of the things we have to change is to make sure that every woman who becomes pregnant and can't afford medical care, gets good nutrition. That would have a dramatic impact on special education by reducing the number of children who need it. We should have early childhood education, 0 to 5, for those children who want it, for those children who need it, and for the families who need it, so that children arrive in school ready to learn. That was goal number one in 1990, and it's over 20 years later, we still haven't met that goal. We need parent education so parents can help and support their children in school, and we need school-based clinics so children can stay healthy. We need school improvement, for sure. The status quo, and I get called a defender of the status quo all the time. I hate the status quo. You should all hate the status quo. It's terrible. Every school should have a full curriculum for every child that includes the arts and history and science, mathematics, civics, geography, languages, physical education, health. There should be music in every school. Music is primal. Every school should have music. Every school should have a library and media center with a person in it. We should have fully resourced schools with extra tutoring for those children who need the extra tutoring. That's what Jeffrey Canada does. Why does he have $200 million in the bank and all of us are crying for funds for basic necessities? And Congress, you could help so much simply by paying the 40% of special education costs that you promised to pay. So what can we do now? There's so much we can do. As I said, visit your congressman, go to your elected representatives, tell them what you need, tell them how wrong it is, tell them we're sacrificing our future. Write letters to the editor, write blogs. When you read ridiculous things in the newspaper, write and complain about it. When you see ridiculous blogs, write comments to them. Get 10 friends to do the same and ask them to get 10 friends to do the same and have them just keep the circle moving out. The bottom line is this. These people who call themselves reformers, who want to privatize our schools and destroy the education profession, have almost all the money and almost all the political power. But things change. Things change because it's a democracy. We all vote, and we should continue to make our voices heard. And one other thing about the reformers, they are few and we are many. So let's make this democracy work for the many, not the few. Let's save public education, save our children, and save our nation. Thank you.
This is Education Radio, and I'm Deborah Polin. You've been listening to education historian Diane Ravitch's keynote speech at the Save Our Schools Conference in Washington, D.C. in July. Education Radio is brought to you by the Education Radio Collective. Check out our blog at education-radio.blogspot.com and find us on Facebook and Twitter. On next week's show, we will hear from educator, author, and activist Jonathan Kozel.